this evening's show was sort of assembled from just some of the vast sea of information that I've been finding in documents and videos that are kind of recently risen to the top of my watch and listen file. As a result, we're going to move from the abuse and programming of individuals and the resultant manipulation of the public mind right to the extensive falsification through time of myth and entire scientific disciplines. This particular run of stuff was instigated primarily by reading Immanuel Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision, which itself was a bit of a coincidence because it had just kind of come off our bookshelves at the same time as I ended up with Gary, excuse me a minute, talking to Eileen Hall about her father's work, Stanley Hall. And he reminded me of, or talking about him reminded me of the theories of catastrophism, of the idea that the solar system has not just kind of swum happily through time on the back of a giant turtle undisturbed since the dawn of time, that quite possibly other things have been going on in between. And Worlds in Collision covers this in some amazing detail. It really is an astonishing book, I think. It's one of the, probably one of the most mind-changing books I've read for a long time, and there have been a few. The instigation, really, for the sort of the first strand in the show this evening was the publication recently by Private Eye of one of its infrequent but regular items debunking satanic abuse. Now, I fully admit that I reckon these come up every 2 or 3 years. Difficult to say, isn't it, because time travels strangely. But when I first came across that story, I'm pretty sure I probably just took it for granted. But it's been now, must be, 15, 20 years of seeing this kind of little meme turn up, not only in Private Eye, it turns up in 14 times, my other organ of choice on occasion too. But each time it turns up, I've noticed that my attitude to it has changed slightly, because each time it comes up, I've learned more about what's going on around me in a world that I don't get to see, but I'm aware that people around me do. And over that time, I've come across the work of people such as Brian Garish, who's probably one of the most informed. And also, it has to be said, TNS's very own Freeman Jack, in kind of sections, until you realise that the basic tenet of the thing really can't be right. The Private Eye's attitude to the subject of ritual abuse is summarised in the most recent article, which I think can be found in issue 1334. And it says, satanic abuse was debunked as a myth by a government-funded inquiry as long ago as 1994. Since then, no physical forensic corroborating evidence has been produced anywhere in the world to substantiate the existence of satanic ritual abuse, in which an international web of devil-worshipping paedophiles are claimed to rape children in satanic rituals, including the sacrifice of babies and animals. Quite an astonishing paragraph, really. There are many subjects that arise by one means or another that are noted in the doctor's surgery in passing, but not actively investigated. After all, there is too much for any individual mind to grasp. That's why there's so many of us. But I remember being particularly horrified many years ago now, because it's again a bit of a mold-breaking book, when I read Angels Don't Play This Harp. And it's a book that deals largely with the High Energy Active Auroral Research Program, which appears to be aimed at turning battlefields to mud on the other side of the planet, or and causing earthquake, who knows what. Disturbing enough subject in itself, but in the process it covers a much deeper story of the now declassified activities that were being undertaken previously by key players in HAARP during the 40s and the 50s. Mind control and human programming was one of the subjects that featured really heavily. And although it seemed to me that the premises of the book were absolutely convincing as far as I was concerned. There was quite enough detail in there for me at the time. I really didn't want to know any more. There were many other things in that book as well, which are thoroughly interesting, but it's the mind control aspect of them that I want to concentrate on this evening. Just hold on a moment whilst I switch the beeps off on the Scottish site. There we go. Should be a little bit quieter for you all. My hard drive, as I said, contains a plethora of videos awaiting a watch and books to be read. Circumstance largely determines when the time comes for these materials to be researched a bit more thoroughly. I'm not sure when the paedophilia thing became a significant thing to me, though I've known about it again for 15 years or so, I guess. The latest I article was, I felt so clearly misleading that I felt that the time had come to look at this material. And the most revealing stuff wasn't actually found in my digital store, but in a pair of podcasts from Freeman Jack, particularly one that's called Monarch Cult Edit, and it's dated November the 11th, 2011, and can be found on the TNS podcast page. The full horrible outing, is pretty vile, but I have no regrets about listening to it and have in fact listened to it two or three times just to make sure that I caught all of what was being said. But there are a couple of sections that are really pertinent to the subjects that I want to cover this evening. Jack begins by playing a podcast of a man called Ted Gunderson, who's an ex-FBI chief. I think he was from California. Talking about his discovery of Satanism and related abuse in America. After he left the FBI, Ted went private, as so many do. And one of the cases he took on was that of a Green Beret veteran who had received three life sentences. Three life sentences for murdering his wife and two children. And after several years and some 2,000 hours of work, it became clear that the man was innocent. Gunderson obtained a signed confession from a girl who stated that her satanic group had committed the murders on an initiation night, and she subsequently yielded ample proof of claim. And this was Gunderson's first encounter with the subject of actual ritual, satanic ritual occurring in the US. In order to try and clear the name of the wrongly convicted soldier, Gunderson rounded up 90 new witnesses, which must have taken a fair amount of work, and brought the case to the attention of the FBI and the Attorney General's office at the Department of Justice. And shortly thereafter, he began to discover that the Bureau was contacting his witnesses and trying to convince them to recant their testimony, I'm sure successfully in many cases. And as he moved on, it also became clear that evidence was being lost, stolen, or destroyed. And it was clear that someone, as they say, did not want this to come to court. In the process, he'd come to the conclusion that there was some kind of loose-knit network which was actively involved in drugs, paedophilia, prostitution, pornography, and child trafficking. By 2007, G had become convinced that he was dealing with an extensive conspiracy, not simply a loose-knit association. And he was also convinced that the driving force behind it all was a satanic cult. And clearly, if you've done the work to get 90 witnesses together for a case, then in all likelihood, you know pretty much all there is to know about the subject that you're looking at. But I guess that it was the discovery that apparently between 50,000 and 60,000 individuals per year were being sacrificed. And just the idea of such statistics must have seriously changed her mind. The podcast, Gunderson expands upon the subject with reference to a case from April 1985 in America which concerned the corroborated testimony of children of a preschool age stating that they'd been taken into tunnels under their preschool to a chamber lit by candles in which they were sexually assaulted by chanting adults wearing robes over their otherwise naked bodies. Sometimes the infants were taken out of tunnels into the bathroom of a next door building and driven to other locations where Gunderson says they were basically prostituted in the community before being returned to school in time to be collected by their parents. By the time Gunderson employed a UCLA archaeologist to investigate these claims, the school had been closed and the tunnels filled in. And thus it took them over a month to conclude that the descriptions given by the children had been accurate. Nothing came of this. No one was interested, even though the discoveries seemed to be related to the McMartin case, which was our subject here. Evidence had to be gathered privately, apparently, because the police, it seems, had no power to investigate because too many influential people were involved. There was no question in Gunderson's mind that this was a satanic operation. And the psychiatrist, also from the UCLA, like the archaeologist, this guy had been studying the subject of abuse networks, and he said that there were 50 other preschools where kids had spoken about being taken into tunnels. And I think that quite a lot of the evidence from children so young comes not so much from speech, although some of it I'm sure does, but I know that that pictures are a tremendous indication of what's going on in young minds if there are adults around paying attention. The whole thing becomes even more disturbing when the story is told of a group of men and children who are found in a Florida park, behaving in a manner which was obviously enough to attract the attention of the local law enforcement officers. And as a result of an interchange, the men's van was searched and traced to an organization called Finders, registered in Washington, D.C. The Finders HQ and warehouse were raided by investigating officers who discovered paraphernalia and documents, including customs forms, dealing with the worldwide trafficking of children. A customs officer who followed all of this up subsequently after these discoveries was told that all the passport data had been transferred to the State Department, that the FBI had withdrawn from the case several weeks prior to the customs inquiries, and that the investigation into the activities of Finders had been taken over as an internal matter by the CIA. The police report into the matter had been classified secret and was not available for review. No further information was available, no action was to be taken, and the case was effectively closed. One more thing. Gunderson also discovered that Finders was or is a front organization founded in the 60s by an agent of the CIA. So the CIA are not only the habitual gun runners and drug dealers we know them to be, they're also international traffickers of children. And now they run Facebook too. How tidy is that? What a time to be living. I'll post the link to that into the chat box when I to the whole thing, because that's just a short bit of the Ted Gunderson. Really, it's the whole vid, which I've watched, is an hour and 20 minutes long and is absolutely full of interesting stuff. There is a thing in the back of my mind which notices that all material only finds its way into the public domain because that's where it's wanted to be. But it's my firm conviction that one way or the other, there's plenty of other sources that are saying exactly this kind of material. You do have to go looking for them. Brian Garish, as I say, is a man I admire tremendously for unbelievable gumption, really, in facing such a difficult subject. I really do believe as well that we're not going to make any progress if this sort of stuff stays as kind of untalked about and hidden as it is. For years I turned away from even looking at it myself, and I am actually, I must admit, finding it quite an interesting experience talking about it on the radio, but I am forced to ask, really, how hard private eye looked before writing that No physical forensic corroborating evidence has been produced anywhere in the world to substantiate the existence of satanic ritual abuse. I guess it's got to make you make you wonder about all the other stuff that you read, because it's just so off the mark. It seems to me that any investigation is going to get smartly stalled, not because there's no evidence, but because the evidence is against the wrong kind of people. I was watching a vid the other day of the inimitable Simon Spaniard giving some advice to the boys in blue, and at the end of it he points out, and I know he's done this, that he's been down the police station to accuse named people of serious crimes, of which there's ample evidence. How far you'd get with it when push came to shove, I don't know, but I guess a point has to be made. And he's been told several times, point blank apparently, that there's just no point because you stand no chance up front, over the counter, in the corporate offices, as it were. I thought it was also interesting to note that in the IE's dismissal of satanic ritual abuse, they're mostly, maybe always, I set fire to them once I finished reading them, so I can't look back, but I think they're mostly, nearly always, by way of reference to a psychotherapist called Valerie Sinison, who is director of an NHS-funded clinic for dissociative studies in London. And in reference to some of the alleged victims of abuse of the late Jimmy Savile, she said that the children made allegations to her independently when they were in therapy in 92 and 93, while she was based at the Tavistock Clinic in London. Sometimes the shit piles up so fast you need wings to stay above it, just like the man says. Further investigation and just briefly further investigation and Jack's aforementioned horror pod reveals that the repeated assault of children younger than 5 or 6 results in just the sort of disassociation in which Sinison and to a fairly large extent Tavistock specialise. The disassociated personality or personalities can be accessed as a means of controlling the individuals concerned. And this turns out to be one of the specific aims of MKUltra, and it's the specific aim that is called the Monarch Project. And it's basically to control the minds of the extremely young when they're in a pre-concrete stage of understanding, connections with and understanding of the physical world sort of haven't yet fully formed. And apart from through drawings and some speech, it can be hard for little ones to report on or properly remember just exactly what has happened to them. And the controlled children become controlled adults, often seeking to visit the same sublimated horrors to which they were subjected onto others. And we'll see that, as we move on, that Velikovsky believes that this has been writ large on the whole planet, that we're suffering from a kind of collective amnesia and a disassociation that is leading to all of the things that are going on around us. And that, I think, is what drove his determination to stick to his guns. Because he took a dreadful kicking, you know, for what he was doing. He really was, the heretic's heretic. And I remember Eileen saying as well that her father got involved in these basic ideas because of the same thing, really, because there's stuff being sublimated across the whole of humanity, which is what is directly resulting in the destructive behaviour that we see around us and our apparent inability to get on with each other. So I went and I had a bit of stuff about MKUltra, which, like I say, had been stored away, and I found an hour or so's video, which was pretty startling. And it seems, at least according to, I think they call themselves 777 Truth. Again, I'll post the link in when I put a tune or so on. Many or even most of the celebrities and stars that are seen daily on films and TV are controlled in this way. The people who we know own the media need to have control over the content, and the content, it appears, it's not just the story or the song, it's the performers too. Walt Disney seems to run its young stars through such a program, and yeah, big popular stars such as Madonna and Michael Jackson and Britney Spears, it is said, are all examples thereof, and each of them can be watched, in fact, and it's called Monarch Programming, MK Ultra Exposed, if you want to go looking for it. Yeah, pretty non-frenzied, but plenty of very peculiar stuff. And then you manipulated and managed individuals with their manipulated and managed products are used on an industrial scale to manage and manipulate the wider public. There's plenty of information in print and on the net which demonstrates how this works and the utterly weird and outrageous effects it has. As I say, I'll post the link in there in a minute. On the wider stage, according to another document, which as a result of listening to a conversation between, I think it was between E.T. and Gary, I got downloaded a copy of Dr. John Coleman's Conspirators Hierarchy, the story of the Committee of 300, which is again is a tremendously authoritative looking document in as far as anything is reliable at all. Which may be nothing. And on the wider stage, according to Dr. John Coleman, the inheritors of Illuminism absolutely believe that they have been charged with implementing, by divine right, a series of policies, one of which is to introduce new cults and continue to boost those already functioning, which includes rock music gangsters, I am quoting, such as the Rolling Stones, and all of the Tavistock-created rock groups, which began with the Beatles. Once again, something that I think I heard about a long time ago. Possibly not, but it's still comes as a bit of a surprise when you think of them, you know. Seems so innocent, doesn't it? The Tavistock Institute was also responsible for the export of the Beatles, apparently, to America, where, of course, they took off hugely and immediately, which became quite a difficult stunt to pull, in fact, moving stuff from over here to over there. Was pretty difficult, but the Beatles broke like the deluge onto the shores of America. And Tavistock was also responsible for the creation of many of the words, the spells and phrases that came to be used in association with an explosion of popular culture. At last, people didn't have to hang around at the youth club listening to Wagner. No one had heard of teenagers till then, it appears. It was a new word, a new concept, and repeated exposure to the Fab Four and their unusual habits, clothes, and musical style were specifically designed and marketed to undermine the young. Actually, as an aside, another very interesting thing there is in the Ted Gunderson thing that I was talking about earlier are the 25. The 25, if you like, articles of incorporation of the Brotherhood of Illuminism. They're 25 aims, as it were, statements of intent. And Starlin, he just summarises them, but oh dear, they make very interesting reading because they basically read like exactly bang on like a description of the real world in which we find ourselves living. So. Even the Beatles were designed to deprave and corrupt, even before they got a bit odd. And pop music is pornography. It's designed to deprave and corrupt, as are at least many of the people that sing it. Well, blimey, what a turnaround, eh? Really is. I sometimes really feel that I'm genuinely living on the other side of some kind of virtual looking glass. And here's another thing that happened to me as a result, because this stuff's all broken in kind of, well, I guess a couple of weeks or so, really. And as a result, I've been wandering around with my with my little MP3 player plugged on as I've been pruning the Willow Theatre, re-listening to loads and loads of tunes from the times, a bit of the Beatles, Roxy Music. There's actually quite a list of them. And of course, every single song sounds different. All the lyrics have come to mean something completely different. The words, the spells, if you like, have been completely transformed just by, effectively, by the reading of a couple of documents. And it is important to say all the other things I've read before, which form a background to the documents that I'm finding now. So I think that's all been a bit hairy. I'll play a tune, put the links to date into the chat box, and see what's going on in there, because I can't actually see it too well at the moment. The track I'm going to play, because it's the one whose lyrics I found particularly striking in terms of content and feeling and everything, they're well worth a listen to, is David Bowie's Oh You Pretty Things, after which I should be back with you, hopefully. Caris Matthews there, Morning Sunshine. I thought I'd play that one just to show that I think there's still some really cracking songs out there. It's not all of them by any means, and I suspect that Caris was so out of control to start with that nobody even tried to get any kind of hold on her. Let me just find back where I was. I lost myself having posted all of my links. Of course, not only are the tunes, people, and presentation designed to do a job if the content's a bit rebellious, the Babylon Broadcasting Company bans it, and that normally increases demand nicely. And if that wasn't enough, once the rush is over and times have moved on, the band tunes are played in a few nice wee spots to add just a touch of the rebel to the corporation. Very cheeky. And in a moment, I'm going to use that as an excuse to inflict upon you "Urban Gorilla" by Hawkwind, which was indeed apparently banned by the BBC. I can't imagine why. I shouldn't think there was a snowball's chance in hell of them playing it anyway. A little bit of the, it's very funny because I thought I'd just check that it had actually been banned, because you know people do put around these wicked rumours, and it says on, I can't remember what the website was, but it says at the time of the single's release, the IRA instigated a bombing campaign in London, and BBC refused to play the single after deliberation, and the brief notion of promoting the B-side instead, it's called Brain Box Pollution, and it dealt with the effects of drug misuse, the band's management opted to withdraw the single, stating that although the record was selling very well, we didn't want to feel that any sales might be gained by association with recent events, even though the song was written by Bob Calvert 2 years ago as a satirical comment. Must have been an amazing bit of timing on the release, eh? And was recorded 3 months ago. Dave Brock was subsequently stated that it was stupid to withdraw it. They were paranoid they'd get bombed. I thought that record was what everything was about in the 1970s. So one more tune before I get back into the meat of the talk. It is Urban Gorilla by Hawkwind, and you're listening to TNSradio.com. So, welcome back. Hawkwind there. Perhaps it was an Illuminati plot that Hawkwind managed to release Urban Gorilla just a little bit before somebody started blowing up London. So, it would appear that many of the facets of modern life that we just kind of take on board as either an entertainment stream or an information stream, we can be pretty sure that it's all part of a vast and dedicated mind control program, to which MKUltra is apparently a major and multifaceted computer contributor. Films and music and sport and, of course, the program laid on us by the television are all using recognized and suitably buffed up individuals to influence we the people, what we believe and how we behave. Actually, on that subject, I was watching last night, I think it was called The Power Principle 2 from Metanoia Films, and it was about propaganda. Quite a lot of stuff you already knew, but really, really neatly laid out. Another one that's out there in front of us now. And they had a little bit of a tale at the end about some research that was done to investigate the effect of television on people, and especially television news. And the specific subject of interest was, I think, the Gulf War. And the basic idea was they asked people. It turned out the basic output of the thing was that the people who watched the most news items about the Gulf War believed they knew lots and lots more than the people who didn't watch any news items at all, or watched very few perhaps. And when they subsequently, having done this little bit of research, they then handed out questionnaires to find out what the actual facts were, how much people actually did know. They did in fact find out that the people who'd been watching the television knew practically nothing, knew certainly less than the people who actually had been getting their information from elsewhere. And I thought that was a pretty good point, actually. It's about not the only good point made by the movie by any means, but it's one that definitely stuck with me. Seems to be at least a little bit of evidence towards the fact that what we've been saying for some time is true, or at least for some people. Revelations over the last couple of years regarding the great stars of rock music have deeply changed my attitude to many of the songs that I thought I knew and loved. Several favourites have dropped from the playlist as a result. It's difficult to appreciate, really, any song any longer that appears to be about love, lust, or physical entanglement, as it's difficult to appreciate these songs as they were appreciated before it became apparent that a substantial portion of the entertainment industry is either involved, implicated, or sunk to the nuts, basically, in gross corruption and small children. The subject of the history of the Earth and its religions and the cosmos has also been highlighted by many individuals, especially over the last couple of years, and in some detail, and in many different contexts. I'll think of, apart from Velikovsky, when I think about this, I think about Santos Bonacci, and Joseph Campbell, and there are other people, each of whom have got their own really beautiful human approach to what is possibly the biggest subject on the planet. The story of our written history and how far it goes back. It doesn't seem to go back very far the way we look at it at the moment, but if you somehow manage to get to the point where you're including rock art and all of that, our history goes back a lot further, i.e. what's been written down. The shared effort into this Earth history, as it were, human history on Earth, whatever we want to call it, has yielded common conclusions amongst certainly the people that I've just mentioned and many more beside them. And these conclusions, common though they are amongst intelligent people who've done their homework, seem still to be steadfastly ignored by the scientific establishment. And this subject too, on close inspection, reveals overwhelming control of minds and information, control that is as apparent, really, in the development of our historical and religious and scientific texts as it is in cutting-edge present-day new media vids and documentaries. And in a sense, I mean, we've spoken before on the show about Dr. Bruce Lipton and Rupert Sheldrake, and I know that Freeman Jack has as well. There is really a whole different science out there which is different from the new science which is being visited upon us. And the voices that are involved in that science, and quite frankly, the clear validity of what they're saying and the rank failure of orthodox science to answer even the most basic questions about what it's doing, is possibly one of the most important developments that's going on, in as far as I think, if there is an overall plan, that's one of the things that might well have been very, very difficult to take into account, is the widespread knowledge of a real science and a real history, rather than the science and history which is being apportioned to us currently. And Emmanuel Velikovsky was really one of the first. He might not have been the first, but he was persistent enough. He published several books, and he was there for many, many years. Best part of 50 years, I think, he was publishing. He was one of the first, and he was certainly the most persistent and most thorough heretic, I reckon, in the modern age, to set his thoughts and energy towards undermining this sustained tower of what is ever more obviously tripe. And just as the knowledge of Tavistock's creation of the Beatles transforms the product, and knowing about widespread abuse of children in the music and entertainment industry changes apprehension of many, many lyrics, I reckon it's true to say that a reading of Velikovsky's Worlds in Collision has transformed the content of my bookshelves. Rather like the song's lyrics. You pick a book up, look at it and think, blimey, this is completely different since I found out not only about Velikovsky, but the support he has from the Thunderbolts project, which I know also is mentioned a fair bit on TNS, and is something which I hope to get into next week, because it is, Velikovsky was one of the inspirations for Talbot, one of the founders of the Cosmic Thunderbolts project. So, once again, I can think of at least a dozen books just as I sit here which are going to have to be reread in the light of Velikovsky and Thunderbolts, really. And after all, are we not looking in this current age at a change in consciousness? I'm at the moment finding it very difficult to keep up with the ideas that fly through my head. But the really amazing thing about it is that it at least appears, and let's face it, we've been fooled by appearances before, but it appears to be replacing a completely incoherent mishmash of stuff, which is even admitted by orthodoxy to be an incoherent mishmash, with something that is much more coherent, and something which, in my case certainly, has driven me to look at all sorts of new material. So really a kind of fairly radical change in not so much consciousness as unconsciousness, because I suspect I'm still asleep, just perhaps getting more distracted. But I still reckon that if all who read the Bible and the Quran, or indeed any of the basic texts from Hinduism or Buddhism, any of them that were not, perhaps not Buddhism, probably, that lie behind the religions and revealed wisdoms of the world, if they were to read and understand the material that's in Velikovsky's books, not only Worlds in Collision, but Ages in Chaos, which deals with what happened to the cosmos in theory before Worlds in Collision occurred, we might well be living on a different planet. Still. So, unsurprisingly, Velikovsky's work has been the subject of sustained criticism, and whilst he did make mistakes, his basic tenet that the Earth and other planets had been subject to cosmic catastrophe in historical times, that had been recorded in the oral traditions, myths and legends of the people of the world, is seriously gaining credibility as more and more people are investigating his work. As I said, not least the sustained, detailed and I think absolutely excellent input from the Thunderbolt Project. Lots and lots of good videos they've got up there. And they're producing scientifically demonstrable information by making predictions about what's going to happen to things like NASA's Comet Impact Project. And their projections are turning out to be a whole lot more accurate than NASA, which remains, as has ever been the case, completely astonished by almost everything that it finds. Worlds in Collision basically describes the last two acts of a great drama. As I say, the earlier acts are covered by Ages in Chaos. And the first of these acts is, he estimates to be about 3,400 to 3,500 years ago. And roughly coincident with the Exodus in the Bible. In fact, coincident with the Exodus. And Act 2, he reckons, happened 2,600 years ago. It's figured that the the last great drama before all of that ended in basically a wall of water. Traditionally, the way peer review often works is that people who've got really good ideas and write really good presentations and all of that are undermined by the fact that they make the occasional mistake, or that there's something that can be pointed to which is evidently wrong. And I've seen again and again that work that 50 years later turns out to be sound is undermined because it has these flaws which are then concentrated on. As a result, one of the things that people have a go at Velikovsky for is because he uses an unusual, what they call synchronical scale. So his means of basically tying together the histories of the world are unconventional, as indeed they would have to be. One of the difficulties is that although these appear to have been global events that Velikovsky is talking about and visible to and written about by everybody all around the globe, as he shows absolutely exhaustively on more or less everything he talks about in the book. One of the things that's made him very difficult to tie together is lack of calendars in some places, disagreement between calendars in others, and so it has been difficult to kind of actually tie together the things that are happening on one side of the planet and being written about and the things that we find, say, in the Bible. And I think what he did was he basically found a papyrus in Egypt, which is an eyewitness account of exactly what it was that appears to be happening in the Exodus. And then he runs his timescale from there. He makes a lot of extremely accurate and perceptive predictions, as we'll hear, on that basis. So I think that if you want to criticize, I feel that if people really want to have a go at that, they have to have a go at how it is that he's coming up with such good results, given the decisions that stylistic choices he took. And I'm aware that other time slips seem to occur elsewhere in his story. Something else that's in the pile to be read is a similar tale in the Legend of King Arthur, which it appears might not be entirely legend. There are loads of uncertainties anyway in the artifacts and in the way artifacts and events are dated, even by orthodoxy, and by the way the stories are told. So, I don't know. Velikovsky's approach, like that of the establishment, may or may not be valid. But as he says in the final analysis, it's not so essential to kind of separate the records of single world catastrophes. It's more important to be able to establish, firstly, that there were physical upheavals, because as we'll hear, that's not even that's accepted really by orthodoxy, although they're coming that way, that there were physical upheavals of a global character in historical times, i.e. when people were writing about them. Secondly, that these catastrophes were caused by extraterrestrial agents. And thirdly, and that's not little grey aliens, that's large balls of rock and fire. And thirdly, that these agents can be identified. And that is basically a very neat summary of the kind of the mission of his book, as it were. That was really strange, this. One of the first things that you come across in the book is he gives a brief history of the geology of the Earth. It's about three lines long. He's got a very tidy summary. And it wasn't only me, I talked to Synchro as well, and she had the same experience, that there's this real feeling of deja vu as we realised that this was exactly what we'd been taught at school. And it says, the planet Earth has a stony shell, the lithosphere. It consists of igneous rock like granite and basalt, with sedimentary rock on top. The igneous rock is the original crust of the Earth, and sedimentary rock is deposited by water. And that's not quite the way it is, but I just remember that pattern of things. And then we're told that Lyell's theory of geological evolution and Darwin's theory of biological evolution have been generally accepted as truth by the natural sciences for almost 100 years. And here again is, in four brief lines, exactly the model that I somehow seem to carry in my head from school. It says the mountains are what is left of plateaus eroded by wind and water in a very slow process. Sedimentary rock is the detritus of igneous rock eroded by rain, then carried to the sea, and there slowly deposited. Skeletons of birds and land mammals in these rocks are presumed to have belonged to animals that waded close to the sea in shallow water, died while wading, and were covered by sediment before fish destroyed the cadavers, or the water separated the bones of their skeletons. No widespread catastrophes have disrupted this slow and steady process. Once again, I remember thinking that. I really do. And now, we can see like the microcosm in a drop and the elements in the stars, he says, and he assumes that gravitation keeps the planetary system together, man and beast on their planet, and the sea within its borders for millions and millions of years, he maintains. The planets have rolled along the same paths, and their moons around them. And man in these eons has arisen from a one-cell infusorium all the way up the ladder to the status of Homo sapiens. And yet, as he points out, man does not know what life is and how it came to be, or whether it arises perhaps from inorganic matter. It doesn't know whether the planets of this sun, whether the planets of this sun or other suns have got life on them, or if they do, whether like the life, whether they're like the life forms around us. It doesn't know how this solar system came into being, only that it did so billions of years ago. It doesn't know what gravitation is, although the phenomenon is deemed to be the law of laws. Being radically readdressed currently, I suspect. It doesn't know what the Earth looks like 5 miles under his feet. And this is another thing that really attracted me to this subject, is that one of the results of having such a dodgy science is that you end up with a load of really interesting anomalies. And if you measure the thickness of the Earth with seismic waves, then it's apparently 2,000 miles thick. But if you measure it using the theory of gravitational effect on mountain masses, it's only 60 miles thick. And it says, more and more, the continents seem to be pastiches of rocks from far corners of the Earth, plastered one atop the other. Specialists in this new field have recognized more than 300 different terrains around the margins of the Pacific. And they quote this really amazing quote, which from a geologist, which says, I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. That's absolutely cracking. I wouldn't have seen it if I hadn't believed it. That seems to me to be absolutely a central idea. I've actually got a couple of collections of scientific anomalies that were edited by a chap called William Corliss. And the books themselves are called Scientific Frontiers, which are kind of collections of his favourite anomalies from a wider selection. And that particular one, that about the rocks being plastered one atop the other, comes from Science in 1983. We don't know how mountains came into existence or what caused the emergence of continents, although we've got some fairly shaky-looking hypotheses about that. We don't know where oil comes from, though again, there are some hypotheses. We don't know why a glacial sheet pressed upon most of Europe and North America, as we believe it did. And we don't know how palms could grow above the polar circle, or how it came about that the same fauna fill the inner lakes of the old and the new world. We don't know where the salt in the sea came from, and why after millions of years on the planet, why have we only got a few thousands of an inadequately recorded history? Worlds in Collision and its companion volume, Ages in Chaos, actually offer some answers. In fact, they have a go at all of those questions, in fact, to these conundra. And the answers come, Velikovsky says, only at the cost of giving up certain notions now regarded as sacred laws in science. The millions of years of the present constitution of the solar system and harmonious revolution of the Earth, with all their implications as regards the theory of evolution. Which is a real paradigm shift in statement, and it certainly seems that we would have to we would have to experience a complete turning upside down of science and the orthodoxy in order to get these ideas through. But obviously, the more heads they're in, the more it affects our morphic field and the more chance there is of it just suddenly arriving like a flood on the scene. Well, what I want to do now is I'm going to put another tune on, and then there's a half an hour or so of podcast called Velikovsky, The Bonds of the Past, and it's a CBC documentary from 1972. It looks great. It's really brilliant, like Spirit of the 70s or what. I'll post the link up in a minute. Coming from the 70s, I don't know whether they were carrying around a hand-cranked reel-to-reel with a piece of sponge or something. Maybe it's just that they chose to interview everybody either in the back of a car or sitting next to an air-conditioning unit. But there's numerous bits of background noise, which on one occasion make it a bit difficult to hear, but it's very brief. The other thing that people seem to comment a lot is Velikovsky's slowness of delivery, but I quite like that myself. So here we go, then. There'll be another tune, which being as we're going to be talking about how long it took them to divorce the gods that were worshipped from the planets, which were the actual objects of the attention, I'm going to play Jesus Just Left Chicago by ZZ.
The catastrophes described in ancient sources were traumatic experiences common to all mankind. Purged from conscious memory, these records are now interpreted as allegories, metaphors, and the trauma has been submerged in the unconscious. Velikovsky calls this collective amnesia.
Hello, I'm Mark Starovich. On this edition of Documentary CBC, a theory about our solar system that sent a scholar on a collision course with mainstream science. It can be thought of as a sort of billiard shot in the heavens. Less than 4,000 years ago, Venus jumps out of its orbit past Earth, knocks Mars out of its orbit, and causes general chaos. Did it happen? Dr. Emanuel Velikovsky thought so, based on various ancient texts. In the 1950s, he was considered a kook. But since then, some of his predictions have turned out to be true. Less than a decade before his death, the CBC profiled him. From the program Tuesday Night in 1972, here is Velikovsky.
Revolutionary theory of the universe based on the records of the past has challenged the fundamental beliefs of modern science for more than two decades. Today, the unexpected findings of space explorations have confirmed many of the predictions of this theory, but the man who proposed it, Emanuel Velikovsky, is still rejected by established science.
Well, I've taken a lot, but they're not very good. You're in too close to both of them.
And if I transgressed and went into many fields of science and humanities, it was not because I was born a rebel. I was coerced to trespass. The belief that we are living in an orderly universe, that nothing happened to this Earth and the other planets since the beginning, that nothing will happen till the end, is a wishful thinking that fills the textbooks, and your textbooks are still of Victorian vintage. Is any physicist here who would stand up and defend the proposition that only gravitation and inertia are in action in the solar system? But of all my heresies, this was the greatest. And let me ask you another question. Is the theory of uniformitarianism, which means that nothing what happens, what happened in the past, could have happened if it doesn't happen today? On this is built the modern geology. On this is built the modern astronomy, and this is built the modern biology and theory of evolution. And so, it is only wishful thinking that we are living in a safe, never perturbed solar system and a safe, never perturbed Earth.
Were born and mountains collapsed. Land and sea changed places. Great streams of lava flowed. The sea boiled and evaporated. Such were the scenes of unimaginable violence during the times of global catastrophe. In Worlds in Collision, Velikovsky describes the last two acts of this cosmic drama as recorded by the ancients. At the time of Moses, 34 centuries ago, a giant comet, which later became the planet Venus, nearly collided with the Earth. On two occasions, the Earth passed through the tail of this comet and experienced intense heating and enormous tides, incessant electric discharges, rains of hot stones, and a deluge of fire. Velikovsky claims that some of the oil deposits originated with the hydrocarbons in the comet's tail. This is also the source of manna that sustained the Hebrews after the exodus from Egypt.
Here in the New York Herald Tribune, explosion in science, the artist's conception of what happened when the heavens burst. What happened during the 1500 BC upheaval, which we read about in the Bible as the exodus of the Israelites from Egypt, and the phenomena or upheaval that that accompanied that. And this is the artist's conception of what happened in Palestine and Mexico and China. Lightning, meteorites being rained down as the comet's head came closer to the earth, followed by floods. Same in Mexico, where water swept over the entire land, great gigantic tides.
In a final collision with Mars, the comet lost the remnants of its tail and became transformed into the planet Venus. Now Mars traveled on an erratic orbit, and in the year 687 BC, it nearly collided with the Earth. There were repeated changes in the Earth's orbit, in the lengths of day, the seasons, and the year. In these catastrophes, entire species of animals were annihilated. Others proliferated from wholesale mutations. Mankind was decimated. Civilizations destroyed. In Velikovsky's world, the heavens are a huge arena where giant comets are born. Planets collide, and huge sparks, thunderbolts, leap between heavenly bodies.
The whole idea of the recentness of cataclysmic events in this part of the universe, the whole idea of catastrophe in the use of science and its base upon its being based on an orderly evolution of things, were very shocking ideas to the high priests of the beautiful symmetry of reason and the natural progression of it.
He knocked out a very strong prop for an obsolete form of science, which is what surprised me about the violence of the reaction, since I would have thought that the scientists themselves had long ago left this behind, and that is Newtonian science, the science which relies on order and a very simple kind of order. God, the geometrician, the clockwork universe that just was wound up at some moment in the distant past and now ticks away in its regular fashion. That he attacked, but on the other hand, he was long gone before he said anything about it. His notion that there...
Eric Larrabee, director of the New York State Council of the Arts.
Is a challenge.
As an editor of Harper's Magazine, he wrote an article on Velikovsky in 1950, just prior to the publication of Worlds in Collision.
One of the surprising things about the pressure that the scientific and scholarly community brought to bear is that it succeeded. The book, Worlds in Collision, then, merely the first of the books, had been on the top of the bestseller list for something like 11 weeks. And nonetheless, the publisher was so mortally wounded, is the only word, by the turning away of salesmen from the doors of professors' studies and all of the implications that went with this, that the book was transferred to another publisher which was willing to take it over, which, after all, is a fairly extraordinary thing in publishing.
Not only was the scientific press carping at him, and in a way that was violent, not in terms of an orderly discussion that this idea is yet to be tested and it takes more time and etc., but saying this idea is crazy and any man who has such an idea is mad, insane, that kind of thing. But the establishment through which men who think that way make a living, the academic establishment, was saying to this man, you know, you're not safe. Now, in the case of most of the young, being themselves, unhappily, is not...
Dr. Birenbaum, president of Staten Island Community College.
In the case of Velikovsky, there is something high, and the cost of being himself has been very, very great. That is a condition to which I think the young profitably can be exposed. And if I had my way, every young undergraduate student in my college, everyone, whether he's in the humanities or the hard sciences, would be required to examine the Velikovsky case. First, because the subject matter of what the man is standing for is very interesting. Very, very interesting. Secondly, because the subject matter is truly interdisciplinary. It's stretching. The third, because the human embodiment of the expression of the ideas, in a way, is symbolic of the problem the young think they are facing in this kind of a society, and which, in my opinion, they, in fact, are facing. Not only them, me.
But what is this condition?
The problem, the condition is the extreme professionalization and rigidification of institutions through which thought is supposed to occur. Extreme to the point where it begins to contaminate the fluidity and looseness, the freedom to think. Fluidity and looseness of ideas, of having ideas, and the freedom to think. And Velikovsky really wasn't taken on by the establishment simply because of what he was saying. He was also taken on by the establishment, in my opinion, because of his audacity in having such thoughts. The man... Yeah, go away, we got a sticker.
Good security force here.
The thing about Velikovsky is that the ideas are so much a part of a man, have been so hammered into his own personality by the controversy, that the ideas themselves are his life. And this man is a fighter for life. He's a fighter for life. He's not going to be bowled over if they all say no. He's not going to give up life. And the survival of the ideas now are so much wrapped up with the survival of the man. And that's what makes for the bravery that we spoke of earlier.
Emmanuel Velikovsky was born June 10, 1895, in Vitebsk, Russia. After receiving a medical degree from the University of Moscow in 1921, he practiced for a time in Palestine. Following a period of study in Vienna, he specialized in psychoanalysis. In 1939, Velikovsky came to New York to pursue research on Freud's three heroes, Oedipus, Akhenaten, and Moses.
First idea that probably moved me into this direction on which I followed since then was the realization that during the Exodus occurred natural happenings, we can call catastrophes, which are reflected in the story of the plagues, in the story of the crossing of the sea, in the story of the rumbling mountain from which they heard the Decalogue, and the trouble in the desert, the wandering in the desert, covered with ash, and some strange phenomena of food falling from the sky. If anything of this really happened, what chances would be that something would be also found in Egyptian story, in some Egyptian documents? In the books of Egyptology, you find nothing about the catastrophe in this, during the long history of Egyptian people. So it was after a document of this nature that I went, and after several weeks I could establish that a certain document, a papyrus, written by a sage by name Ipuwea, a papyrus stored since early part of the 19th century in the University Museum or the University Library of Leiden in Holland, is exactly a story of the plagues described by an Egyptian eyewitness. So here I had a synchronical point between two histories, biblical and Egyptian.
The papyrus of Ipuwer synchronized biblical and Egyptian events and led to a reconstruction of ancient history. Many questions debated for centuries found an answer. In the Bible, the identity of the beautiful Queen of Sheba at the court of Solomon was unknown. In Egyptian records, the land of Punt, visited by Queen Hatshepsut, could not be determined. In Velikovsky's reconstruction, it is clear that Punt is the land of Solomon and Hatshepsut is the Queen of Sheba. The biblical story of Joshua, with the sun standing still in Gibeon and the moon in the valley of Ajalon, presented another realization.
I was struck by the fact that two lines or two verses before the story of the sun and moon disturbed in their daily motion was the story of large stones that fell from the sky and destroyed more of the enemy soldiers than the sword of the Israelite. And this combination, because combination of stones and disturbance in rotation of the earth, the ancient couldn't know that it was the earth that was disturbed in rotation, that's of the moon and the sun, made me immediately to follow the path toward east and west. And I found without great difficulty that in western hemisphere, which means here on this continent, the story persists too. The story persists among the Redskins, it persisted among the Mayas at the time when the continent was first conquered, the Mexico part of it, by the Spaniards, namely that the sun was rising just over the eastern horizon when it dropped back and came a little up again and stand there without motion, and all the forests burned. Again, the Redskins could not know about the heat resulting from disturbance in Earth's rotation. So, of course, this would be not enough. You had to go to all civilization, to Japan, to China, to India, to Persia, to Babylonia, to Assyria, to Asia Minor, to Greece, to Rome, to Judea, to Egypt, to Mexico, to Peru, to Iceland, and for oral transmission, even to East Indies. And the same story could have been found in all places, but differently told, so that it was no question of just borrowing from one nation by another. So this was the conclusion, the story of human memory of catastrophes that took place in historical times, but strangely, despite the fact that they were described in so many sources, as if non-existent for the scientific world.
According to the earlier records, the origin of the Great Flood is Saturn, which was referred to by the ancients as a water planet.
And we have information in mythological sources that two filaments, I wouldn't like to say comets, filaments of erupted mass from Saturn reached the Earth and engulfed it in the age.
Water fell.
Enough to fill Atlantic Ocean.
And what was the water that fell? What was it like? I always liked that.
Water?
The water that fell in the flood, what was it like?
It was salty. What else can I say? It was a little warm described. It was salty. It was not really hot.
Other ancient documents tell of the thunderbolts of the planet god Jupiter. Velikovsky understood that these thunderbolts referred to electromagnetic discharges between planets. This led to his claim that radio noises must emanate from Jupiter. In 1955, radio noises from Jupiter were discovered. It was this prediction and discovery that finally convinced Einstein of the merit of Velikovsky's ideas.
I knew Einstein since 1921 or 22. At that time, I came from Russia just after I obtained my medical degree. Einstein was already a famous man, actually in the prime of his fame. My idea was to bring together the Jewish scholars and scientists from various disciplines and from various countries in one work which I call Scripta Universitatis. It has a longer title. This was my beginning with Einstein. I was the general editor. He was the editor of Mathematics and Physics. We met again in this country, and in 1940, again in 1946, but a real debate started soon after I moved to Princeton in 1952. And for 18 months, we discussed one subject, always the very same subject. And the point in the debate, always the same, was whether electrical and magnetic fields are participating in the celestial mechanism, or only gravitation and inertia, as he would claim, because this was the view not only of his, but of all scientific community. And so this was a debate. At one point in that debate, I offered in a letter in June of 1954 to stake our positions on a claim that I made, that Jupiter sends out radio noises. And if you wish I said it would be easy to find out. He wrote his comments on the margin as usual. 9 days before his death, but he was in good state yet. He wished to see me. I brought the news. I brought the news that this was discovered. Radio noises were discovered by chance, and those who discovered them, two scientists of Washington, D.C., for weeks and weeks could not establish from where the noises came. They thought about some terrestrial origin, some neighboring station disturbance. Finally, they had to come to the conclusion that it was from the extraterrestrial source, and namely, after more deliberation, from Jupiter.
This prediction and confirmation of radio noises from Jupiter convinced Einstein to seek crucial experiments on Velikovsky's ideas. After Einstein's death, his estate wrote letters to this effect, but with no result.
Later on, when I felt, and I know Dr. Velikovsky felt, that a very considerable amount of evidence had piled up, which was very helpful, to put it mildly, to his side. And the resistance of the professional journals to taking all this seriously was still as great as it had been at the start. And I felt also myself a degree of obligation. I wanted to pay my respects to him, and I wanted to pay some of my intellectual debt to him. And so I wrote, and Harper's accepted the second article, attempting to bring people up to date and give some of the items that had come along.
As late as 1959, the surface temperature of Venus was calculated to be roughly the same as that of the Earth. But in 1962, the Mariner probes to Venus found it to be 800 degrees Fahrenheit. The probes also found hydrocarbons in the atmosphere of Venus. In 1946, Velikovsky had stated these two tests, the heat of Venus and the presence of hydrocarbons, to be crucial to his idea that Venus is a newcomer to the solar system.
Now, my line of thought was this. Venus erupted from Jupiter only several thousand years ago. Jupiter, by the way, is 400 times heavier than Venus. And so it was the natal heat, and then the change of motion into heat when Venus traveling on a extended ellipse met on its way other celestial bodies, twice meeting the Earth. And electrical discharges also took place between Venus and other celestial bodies, even its parental body, Jupiter. These and other causes, radioactivity that was engendered, resulted in heat, and Venus was observed by the ancient as a very brilliant incandescent body, rivaling the sun in its brightness. So it is also described by the Chinese, by the Babylonians, by the Mexicans. I claim that it might be close to incandescent. And finally, 11 years after World Ecology was published, after the radio noises were observed coming from Jupiter, other planets were investigated on radio signals, and radio signals coming from Venus were found, but of different nature, of thermal nature. indicating that Venus is hot. It was unbelieved, and therefore the main task of Mariner 2, Mariner 1 didn't succeed, of Mariner 2 in December 1962 was to find out whether Venus is really hot. At that time, it was found that it is something like 600 degrees, and the announcement was made that it's most probably a mistaken result. But at that time I wrote that most probably it will be found more than 600. And truly, a few months later, it was announced it is 800 degrees Fahrenheit, and today it's already found that it's over 900 degrees Fahrenheit on the bottom, under the clouds. Okay. A temperature at which many metals are molten.
Following the confirmations of the Mariner probes, Velikovsky brought the success of his predictions to the attention of the scientific community. Dr. Motz, Department of Astronomy at Columbia, is the past president of the New York Academy of Science.
After Velikovsky had come to me, I agreed to write a letter to Science delineating his statements, his discoveries, stating that Venus would be found to be very hot, that radio emanations would be found coming from Jupiter, and a number of other things that we specified in the letter. So Dr. Bargman and I did indeed write that letter to Science, indicating that regardless of whether one believed this to have stemmed from Velikovsky's theory, his prior rights to discovery ought to be recognized. And then we indicated that we did not accept his theory as such, but we did accept his discoveries. See. After we had written the letter, the argument was started again, and people did write to me saying that I perhaps should not have done this because clearly saying that Velikovsky had announced these things did not specify the truth of his arguments. And I indicated that I felt that a person who had made an announcement who had indicated certain things ought to be given credit for these things.
Do you feel these are very unusual statements to have come true?
Yes, they are very unusual because nobody suspected that Venus would be as hot as it was found to be. And people had no reason to suppose that radio waves would come from Jupiter and that these other things would be found to be so, or the carbohydrates that are thought to be on Venus and things of that sort.
So why did these other scientists feel that this was not proper on your part?
Well, because they felt it would lend support to what they thought was an irrational theory, you see. As a matter of fact, there's nothing irrational about the theory. It is just Velikovsky does not depart from accepted scientific arguments and scientific theories. It's just that there's no evidence that his ideas apply to this situation at all. See, that is the point.
What he was saying ran against what the high priests of the disciplines felt was the best evidence of the time. In the areas of his probe involved sectors where best evidence itself was questionable. What was best evidence in those areas?
You cannot get a body to do what he says Venus did without altering entirely the distribution of masses in the solar system. The solar system is an extremely stable system. You can't make Venus go change from one orbit to another in that way. The sun dominates. The sun is in the center, and therefore there's a regularity that cannot be altered.
When I was born intellectually, reason reigned supreme at the University of Chicago. Even after World War II and Hitler, the answer to everything was man's mind. And the beautiful part of being a student at the University of Chicago then was the feeling that nothing was beyond the thought of man, and no problem was beyond his rational solution.
Twenty years ago, I thought you could persuade people. And now, again, I think of that terrible remark of Max Planck's, that you don't persuade people of anything. The believers in the old ideas die off one after another. That's all that happens. It's a very sad experience how little attention people pay to what one would think is...
Well, that was an extract from... a 1972 CBC documentary called Velikovsky, Bonds of the Past. I posted a link to, there's quite a lot more material in it. I think it's probably almost twice as long as that in reality. You're listening, of course, to Dr. Rock's radio show on tnsradio.com and Scottish Sovereigns on the land.ning.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. Whilst that was playing, I found one of my favourite anomalies out of the Corliss book, which concerns the geology of the Earth, and it's something I saw a long time ago and strikes me as being a pretty fair description of the presentation of most of the stuff we find around us. The thing about the Corliss books is he spent 50 years or so eyeballing peer-reviewed journals and extracting any anomalies that were accepted after peer review. Like, now, it gives him a fair scatter of different magazines to choose from. But this little one is called Too Many Pages Missing, and concerns whether the geological model that we find ourselves, as described earlier, is anything like accurate. And it says, the geological record has often been likened to pages in a book, each rock formation being a page, etc. The problem is that this book is not even close to being complete over most of the Earth. Woodmerap has examined the massive geological literature and drawn an extensive and most impressive suite of world maps showing just where the 10 major geological periods are represented and where they're absent. The statistics are disturbing. Two-thirds of the land surface display 5 or fewer periods. 15 to 20% of the Earth's surface has 3 or fewer periods appearing in the correct order. Where are all the missing pages? Why, missing pages mean only that no deposition occurred in an area during the period in question, or, if it did, erosion wiped it off the record. The book of strata forming the vaunted geologic column is really a composite of a few scraps from here and there. The enormity of what is missing is made all too clear by Woodmerap's maps and statistics. And that comes from John Woodmerap's Essential Non-Existence of the Evolutionary Uniformitarian Geologic Column, a Quantitative Assessment. That's a good one. Now, of course, one of the peer-reviewed periodicals that is included in this is the Creation Research Society Quarterly, which means that it's written by creationists and peer-reviewed by creationists. Shines an interesting light on the idea of peer review, eh? But another thing I like about Corliss is that 50 years in the field, as it were, he's got a kind of encyclopedic knowledge and a very sharp editorial scalpel, and he puts little comments occasionally after things that he thinks are worthy of it, referring you to other things that might be of interest, connected and the like. But on this one he says, do missing geological pages constitute anomalies? Not when taken one by one, he says, for occasional lapses are to be expected. But taken en masse, the record seems so skimpy that one wonders. Woodmerap turns the knife by emphasizing that the most fossils used for dating overlap anywhere from the most fossils used for dating overlap anywhere from a few to all 10 periods, further compounding the uncertainty. There's so many holes. This is the thing. See, there's just so many holes in the stuff that we've been told to believe. And the reality does not in any sense kind of match up to the theory in so many areas. And I think that is what makes this such a transformatory process, if you like. But as we heard in that podcast from CBC, Velikovsky was effectively from the word go on a collision course with the theories of mainstream science. And, you know, this was not an unpopular book, as you can probably tell from the ideas that were being put across in the podcast. It's very accessible stuff. He writes really well, and once again, there's not a lot of wasted stuff, not a lot of unneeded adjectives or repetition or any of that. The copy I've got, as I put in the chat box earlier, was published in 1973, and it is the 18th impression since 1950. So that's 18 impressions in 23 years. There were a couple in the year of publication, 1950, and then five more impressions in 1951. So it really kind of took the public by storm. It was very popular, as I think was Velikovsky amongst younger audiences, although, of course, the older members of the population seemed to steer clear. His greatest heresy, as was made clear, it was amongst so many, but his greatest heresy was to question the assertion that the only determinants of planetary motion as observed were gravity and inertia. And yet, although his suggestions came as a shock to what was described as the high priests of an obsolete science, Newton's theory of celestial mechanics and the uniformitarian cosmos was dying long before the publication of Worlds in Collision, as is often the case. And once again, there's lots of reasons to state that if you look back, but the one that interested me was the signs that are found it apparent really in archaeology. Before we ended up with a theory of geological evolution, kind of as previously outlined, and the theory of Darwinian evolution, stemming from the same stable as Brave New World, there was a character called Cuvier, who lived, apparently, we're told, between 1769 and 1832, and he founded vertebrate paleontology, the science of petrified skeletons of animals possessing vertebrae, all the way from fish to man. And he was much impressed by the picture presented by the sequence of layers on Earth. And I'll just try and find, there's a paragraph here. This is Cuvier writing. When the traveller passes over these fertile plains, where gently flowing streams nourish in their course an abundant vegetation, and where the soil, inhabited by a numerous population, adorned with flourishing villages, opulent cities, and superb monuments, is never disturbed, except by the ravages of war, or by the oppression of the powerful, he is not led to suspect that nature also has had her intestine wars, and that the surface of the globe has been broken up by revolutions and catastrophes. But his ideas change as soon as he digs into that soil which now presents so peaceful an aspect. And that is Cuvier basically encountering, presumably through the actions of his own spade and looking at the works of people who'd done some of the digging, it was him encountering exactly what was just described from the anomaly book there, that we have this this theory, which as soon as you put it to any kind of serious test, just collapses, as it has to be said, so many theories do. Cuvier believed then that great catastrophes had taken place on this Earth, repeatedly changing seabeds to continents and continents into seabeds, hence the disturbance of all of the layers. He held that genera and species were unchangeable since creation. But observing different animal remains in various levels of Earth, he concluded that catastrophes must have annihilated life in vast areas, leaving the ground for other forms of life. Where did these forms of life come from? Either they were newly created, or more likely they migrated from other parts of the world which were not at that particular time visited by cataclysms. And he couldn't find the cause of these cataclysms, looking as he was down rather than up. And he saw in their traces the basic problem in geology that it is the of most importance to solve. But he realized that in order to resolve it satisfactorily, it would be necessary to discover the cause of whatever the events were that had disturbed the very fabric of the planet itself. an undertaking, he says, which presents a difficulty of a quite different kind. He knew of many fruitless attempts already made, and he didn't find himself able to offer a solution. And he said, these ideas have haunted, I may almost say have tormented me during my searches amongst fossil bones. Now, there are several points raised in the CBC documentary that are really bang on the basic thrust of this show, which is to look first of all at the nature of mind control propaganda and the control of ideas. It didn't take very long after It didn't take very long after Worlds in Collision was published and it was published by a scientific publisher, because it is a scientific text, although there's absolutely no equations in it at all. It still doesn't deviate very much from your basic scientific output and attitude. But once it was published by this scientific publisher, all the other scientists on near as damn it all the other scientists that were published by the people who had chosen to publish Velikovsky refused to allow any further text to be published by that publisher. Now they have peer review, folks, red in tooth and claw in the field. We're not talking about people looking at his work and having a go at it in writing and enabling some sort of chat in the chat room and some sort of backwards and forwards in the forum or what have you. We're talking about them literally withdrawing all of their books from Velikovsky's publisher. And the boycott basically led by force, of course, to a new publishing deal. And I should think the new people that published Velikovsky probably made considerably more than on Worlds in Collision and the other books than the guys that had let him go. Isn't that always the way? No courage, didn't have the courage of their convictions, it would appear, maybe had their own sound commercial reasons. As we heard, the scientific press didn't just criticise him, they carped violently was the phrase that was used on the subject. They were not suggesting that his material needed to be reviewed. They were saying that the material was insane and that the author was a kook. And yet, as the head of the community college said, he said, every young student in my college, if I had my way, would be required to study the Velikovsky case, not only because he's very, very interesting, but because he's truly interdisciplinary. And that, again, I think is one of the keys. We know, don't we? We talk on TNS, I'm sure it gets referred to a lot, about compartmentalization, about the separation of one thing from another, people getting little jobs that are in their area of expertise, which means they can be well paid to do a thing which isn't apparently connected to anything else. And that way, lots of people can get to be doing lots of things, the end of which is not entirely clear. And one of the biggest menaces there is to that sort of approach is interdisciplinary study. And Velikovsky, he did something of the astronomy, something of the physics. He was a psychiatrist by trade. He was like Joseph Campbell, he became a sort of master of myth, because that was the basis of looking at the oldest stuff. So he was looking right across the piece. He was getting some kind of sense of the whole picture. And so he was getting some kind of sense of what may turn out to be the closest thing we have to an approximation to a real history. And that was one of the things that I think really made him very, very unpopular. The guy from the community college also said he's the human embodiment of the expression of ideas, symbolic of the problem the young think they're facing in this kind of society, and which, in my opinion, they are now facing. And if it was true in 1950 that, it's so much more so now. And again, the human embodiment of the expression of ideas. He was, and he stuck to it as well. He wasn't beaten down, and one way or the other, he stuck with it really right to the end of his life. in effect, the attitudes that are expressed by the mainstream, he said, represent the extreme professionalization and rigidification of institutions through which thought is supposed to occur. And by supposed, I think we might say that's where ideally it would be happening. And the other sense, of course, is that that is where people think it is happening. But through the professionalization and rigidification, we get a whole load of administrative details and personal issues that interfere with the actual transference of knowledge. And he points out that this extreme activity is extreme to the point where it begins to contaminate the fluidity and looseness, the freedom to think. Once again, I guess nowadays that is not only carried out by the by this sort of means, by the way that ideas are presented or rejected, but also through all sorts of other means in our diet and the air and the water we drink and all of that. There are all sorts of activities now that might be said, realistically, to contaminate the fluidity and looseness and the freedom to think. And in his reach to seek to the heart of the mystery that had got to, seized him by the vitals, as it were, Velikovsky sought information from all cultures across history. The book is absolutely full of quotations from all over the world, and he listed a lot of those, I think, in the documentary there. And he was looking into their myths and writings and iconography, because all of these things change over time. And he concluded that common expression across time and space most likely arises from common experience. This again seems like a really simple idea when you first come across it, but it's not an idea that is normally held. It is exactly the conclusion that Joseph Campbell came to. He too spent an entire long life looking at the myths that were told around the world, and he too came to the conclusion that the common expressions he was finding, and there were many of them, there were many myths that were at least deemed to have been apparent in societies, in many different societies, without any contact across space or time. And there are ways of telling, really, when you've looked at so many different things, there seem to be ways of telling when something is a genuine arising of the culture that you're looking at, and when it has been inherited from elsewhere, or when it has arrived from somewhere else, having been embroidered upon. And a lot of the stories that are told in Worlds in Collision, of the world standing still and the sun remaining in the sky for a couple of days, are found all over one half of the globe, as it were. And once you manage to get the timing sorted out, you go looking for the stuff dated over on the other side of the world, and find that, yeah, indeed, over there was a couple of nights of darkness. And in fact, that's probably the most commonly known idea, although again not commonly accepted, but there are many, many examples of similar things in the book. There's many examples of things seen from one side of the world, which by definition would have looked slightly different and appeared slightly later and various other things. And as a result, there is an exact correlation, and one that's really undeniable, because it would have been extremely difficult to engineer that kind of accuracy across the piece. So the stories are told really slightly differently in each context, and this suggests that they weren't copied. They're specific to the cultures in which they're found, but apart from that, they clearly describe more or less identical events in clear and basic terms. Lack of elaboration and enhancement by reference to the earliest sources in each locale suggests strongly that, as I say, it's not a case of Chinese whispers. The similarity of memories are often modified slightly by physical position on the earth. shows that these events happened in historical time, i.e. after some means of recording the data had been developed, be it by spoken narrative, rock art, pictographs, or writing. Of course, our current history only really extends as far as writing. That's the line, if you like, in the proverbial sand. If it's not in writing, then it didn't happen. And once again, despite being described by so many varied sources all over the world, in the scientific world, it's as if none of this information exists. And again, how can we even begin to come up with some kind of reasonable theory as to what's going on when we're apparently just writing off so much stuff that is apparent in so many places and through so many peoples? When Gary and I spoke recently with Eileen Hall, we heard that at some point in the past, Saturn was closer to the Earth, clearly visible in daylight, and was as bright as the sun. This was the golden age of Saturn. According to Velikovsky, this ancient encounter culminated in two what were described as filaments. Obviously, it has to be a translation into English, and that would be the best they can have done. But I think there's pictures too, which quite possibly we'll be able to show next week. But this encounter with Saturn culminated in two filaments from the giant planet engulfing the planet Earth, and that the deluge that followed was of salt water. And of course, it is Velikovsky's claim that's where the salt in the water of the oceans of the Earth came from, largely. There is a hypothesis, I think it's something to do with sodium chloride in rocks and the dissolution of it and running down into the sea and all that kind of stuff, but by and large, I think you'd need many, many orders of magnitude, possibly more times more the amount of sodium chloride in the rocks to get the overwhelming amount of salt that's in the sea. So Velikovsky said it came from this electromagnetic interaction with Saturn. And this, he reckons, is the deluge that's likely to have been remembered by surviving cultures worldwide, the one that Noah successfully got away from. And that, as we have heard before, is a recurring story. Noah's not the only name for the character involved in that. He's pretty much a pan-world character. We've heard before, again, hydrogen and other more complex elements are expressed as part of an electrical discharge in plasma. It seems likely to Velikovsky that the filaments witnessed and recorded by our ancestors were just such a discharge, resulting from the close proximity of two heavily charged entities, Earth and Saturn. And here's another, that is a fair point, we would have thought, in the lack of, given the absence of any other evidence as to what was going on at that time. But once again, the whole scientific community believed, and the vast majority of it still seems to believe, that gravitation and inertia are the only contributors to cosmic harmony. The whole shooting match is consistently presented by orthodoxy, accepting as it does the model of celestial mechanics born of Isaac Newton. The whole shooting match is presented effectively as electrically neutral. Velikovsky predicted that radio waves, electromagnetic transmissions, would be found emanating from Jupiter, and indeed this turned out to be the case. But orthodoxy wasn't really interested in looking into this any further. It knew it couldn't be right, and so had no interest in really looking at it. And this is another basic method that I think we're beginning to see all the time, that I think the most obvious recent example, I think I've come across several more, but the easiest one that comes to mind at the moment comes from the physical evidence of the great going away of buildings in New York. The National Institute of Science and Technology, according to its own report, knew that explosives were not involved. They knew that it was the putative planes alone that destroyed the buildings, and so evidence for the presence or absence of explosives was not sought. And that, again, once you see it one or two times, you begin to realise that that's another very interesting pattern. The way you come across your wrong information can be justified in all sorts of ways, and that's a really, I guess, an easy way of making sure that people in there on the job doing the checking perhaps just don't look, I don't know. But again, as I say, it's something that, in terms of control ideas, that seems to me to be a fairly major approach. Another one, more peer review in action, I suspect, after the boycotting of the publisher, was the resistance of professional journals after the discovery of these Juvian radio waves was just as great as at the start of Velikovsky's campaign so many years earlier, despite the fact that evidence was piling up to support his theory. He also predicted that, correctly, as we now know from the evidence yielded by the Mariner probes, and also since then we've had a pair of Pioneers and a pair of Voyagers, been some pretty amazing technology chucked out there, some of it's still working, I gather. We gather that the atmosphere of Venus, he predicted that it would contain hydrocarbons and that the planet's surface would be much hotter than orthodox expectations, and that, like Jupiter, Venus would be found to emit electromagnetic signals in an electromagnetically neutral cosmos in the form of radio frequencies. Dr. Motz, Einstein had a go at convincing somebody to look into this stuff further after the Jovian radio waves, or at least allegedly. I've had a bit of an eye opening in the chat box whilst the podcast was playing regarding Einstein. So there's another idea that's completely changed. But Dr. Motz, a past president of the New York Academy of Science, tried another approach. He tried a different approach to try and get some kind of recognition. And he wrote to the journal Science, which is seriously orthodox tome, that is. That has savagely cut the legs from one or two people, that one. So I don't think it's quite as proactive in that as Nature is, but nonetheless, it's a dangerous place to try and publish for some people. But Dr. Motz wrote to Science, delineating some main and pretty undeniable statements from Velikovsky about his discoveries and the predictions that he outlined previously, and he suggested only that whether or not the ideas were valid as a whole, that Velikovsky's prior rights of discovery should be recognised, which is one of the things that surely we are trying to embed in patent and copyright and all these other similar means of peer review by another name. Motz himself indicated that he didn't accept the overall theory as such, whilst he did accept the validity of the key deductions. And despite the fact that no one expected or supposed any of these planetary characteristics, and as I think I've said before, there was a BBC documentary some time ago about Pioneer and Voyager, and it's many episodes, can't remember, 8 or 10 of them, each an hour long or something, lots of stuff showing loads of amazing pictures of all the planets and all the moons, and it is characterized fundamentally by scientists being completely surprised by almost absolutely everything they're finding and having no kind of explanation for it at all. So it is genuinely true. You don't have to look very far to find out that really nobody expected or supposed that any of this stuff was going to happen, and surely the idea of science, any kind of proper science, should be to have some kind of explanation for what you're looking at, so that when you see new stuff, you might be able to come up with an explanation for it. But none of this stuff was expected, not the hydrocarbons on Venus, not any of it, not the radio waves, not the extra heat, not any of it was expected. And despite the fact that, you know, using his techniques, Velikovsky had come up with some demonstrable hypotheses, shall we say, the establishment felt that to show any interest at all, basically, would lend support to an irrational theory. Now, on that basis, it seems to me that what's going on here is a bit of projection, because it seems to me that, as, once again, in so many cases, your man was being actually quite rational. By the exercise of reason and intellect. He was deducing stuff from the limited facts he had, and those deductions proved to be, you know, verifiable in a sense. So that is rational, not irrational. And yet the establishment projected its own irrational ideas and blamed them on Velikovsky, basically pinned them on him, projected them on him, and got away with it. Once again, as has been pointed out many times before, and we've pointed out many times again, so much of the stuff, that propaganda movie I referred to earlier, one of the things that just hits you again and again and again in it is that every single thing the Americans are, every single word that they're using to describe Russia and the imminent peril of communism whilst they're actually attacking the Third World, every single word of it is a description of what America is doing. Even more amazingly, I guess it's a description of what it is acknowledged in the documentary, that really Russia, A, wasn't in the position to do nearly any of the stuff that was being projected upon it, and also it seems pretty clear that it didn't want to do it either. So again, that is one of the, what we're seeing here is one of the essences of propaganda, I'm sure, which is the projection of the characteristics of one side on another. And as Marx pointed out, there's nothing irrational about his theory. Velikovsky doesn't fundamentally depart from established scientific modus operandi. He doesn't depart really from the arguments or theories. It was just that what Velikovsky said ran counter to what the high priests of the discipline thought was the best evidence at the time. I'll say the use of thought there is a very generous choice of word. There's little evidence of thought in any of this. It's simply a matter, it seems to me, of dogmatic belief in the face of contrary evidence. Really? Am I crazy to think that? And as Bruce Lipton has suggested before, sometimes it's hard to slip even like the finest of feeler gauges between the suppositions of science and the beliefs of a religion. In fact, he said that after 10 years of working in academia, he suddenly realised that his aim to do science rather than religion had been completely undermined by the fact that, despite the fact that he'd become a scientist and was teaching that, he suddenly realised he was actually teaching a religion. And here we can see it, actually in action. Science as religion. And surely we've got to question the use of the words best evidence as well, given the apparent quality of the minds that were examining whatever evidence it was that they were considering. As I said, there's more to the documentary as well than the bits that I played. In the parts I didn't play, Velikovsky made several predictions about the characteristics of the moon itself, possibly the single most anomalous object known to man. And the predictions he made about that ran, as so much of his other stuff, completely counter to orthodox assumptions. He suggested that examination would reveal the remnants of a magnetic field from its encounters with other charged bodies, that water from close encounters with Saturn would be found, or evidence of water, and they did find rust just below the surface. He reckoned there'd be higher than anticipated levels of neon and argon, vestigial radioactivity, and an outflow of heat from beneath the lunar surface. All of these suggestions turned out to be correct, as far as we can tell, eh, folks? That's a completely different subject. Yeah. It has to be admitted that his idea that the moon was molten at some point in the very recent past remains unproven. His theory there, of course, is that encounters with large heavenly bodies would have far more effect on the moon, which is a lot smaller than the Earth, and effectively the moon would find itself possibly struggling between massive influences, effectively being, to anthropomorphize, it was effectively being fought over by two electromagnetically charged entities that were close to it, whereas it was used to only one. And just as on the Earth that leads to some kind of difference in the, I guess, that the rotation and movement of the things that are inside, as compared with the things that are outside, a vast amount of heat is generated. For what it's worth, in my opinion, Velikovsky's theory on that will eventually turn out probably to be correct as well, because his theory seems, well, basically seems to me to be consistent with other aspects of the moon that are well anomalous and unexplained anyway. So why did ancient people serially worship planets that the average person, like, couldn't pick out in the night sky? Saturn, then Venus, then Mars. Each of which moved from being unrecorded, more or less, and sometimes just unrecorded, to being of absolutely key and central importance. And after a while, everywhere, all over the world, they then recede once more into the narrative background, only to be replaced by the next celestial object of veneration. Could it be that Velikovsky was right? Could it be that planets approach so close to the Earth that they could not only be seen at night, but during daylight as well? And that the results of such proximity were repeated cataclysms on the surface of the home of our ancestors? Apropos of those questions, on the subject of the tiny rocks that constitute the moons of Mars, Velikovsky pointed out that Jonathan Swift wrote about these in Gulliver's Travels, which was published in 1726. And in July 2008, a man called Stephen Novella offered us the following gem in his Neurologica blog, which is itself tagged as your daily fix of neuroscience, skepticism, and critical thinking. And I quote, "I was recently asked about the claim that Swift wrote about the moons of Mars in Gulliver's Travels, published in 1726, and that he knew that there were two moons, and exactly described their size and orbital period. The implication is that Swift somehow knew about the moons of Mars, Phobos and Deimos, and a century and a half before they were discovered." Amazing. The blog then, somewhat unaccountably, says, "It turns out that his predictions, if you can call them that, were accurate enough to be an interesting coincidence, but not so close as we have to consider it anything but that, and exactly described their size and orbital period. Without lenses, he was doing well to know they were there, let alone their size and their orbital period." Velikovsky suggests that Swift had access to ancient texts no longer extant, and that they were the source of this seeming prescience. Seems reasonable enough to me. We know there's plenty of no longer extant documents. We know there's plenty of no longer extant information, and it has been becoming less extant as time goes by, and just from one or two of the things I've seen, things were a lot more extant when Swift was around. I love prescience as well. Prescience is defined as knowledge of actions or events before they occur, foresight. That's exactly what Velikovsky has been showing. Knowledge of events before they occur. Well, not events, perhaps that's a bit generous, but knowledge of stuff that he had to kind of like make up in his head and write down so that somebody could see it and come to believe the spell a little later down the line. Prescience. Before knowledge of action or events, before they occur. Prescience. Pre-science. Love it. So, I'm going to have a good lord look at that. Gotta play a couple of tunes in a minute, but to return to the subject of control of ideas and propaganda, you might, if you're going to have a look at the CBC documentary that I excerpted earlier, you may also like to have a look at how Babylon Broadcasting's flagship series Horizon treated this subject when it came up in 1972, which was the same year as the CBC documentary, as I said, excerpted earlier. And in my opinion, there's a very, very marked difference between the treatment of basically the same material. The Horizon documentary is called Worlds in Collision, BBC Horizon 1972. I'll post the link in a minute once we play a couple more tunes. Then I want to come back. Just with a little bit in conclusion from the actual book itself. And my hope is that next week we might look at a little bit more of the Velikovsky and into what is exactly happening in the modern world, because that is really exciting. We've touched not only on the Thunderbolts project, but there are other things that I know I've actually been talking about since I started doing the Dr. Rock show, concerning the state of the climate and the cosmos and the electrical charge in the atmosphere, loads of things. And it's all of that's coming together as well. So as a result, I ended up with considerably more stuff than can possibly be squeezed into 3 hours. But like I said, time for a bit more tunage. So it came up in the chat box just a little bit earlier this evening about craters. Would have thought that craters on planet Earth would have made it quite clear what was going on. And until the very recent past, there wasn't much published evidence. There is quite a lot of published evidence in the anomaly books, and it says that after being ridiculed for well over a century, astronomical catastrophism is now coming into its own. Firstly, there was the admission that a few small craters, like Meteor Crater in Arizona, just might be of meteoric origin. Then more and bigger craters, astrobleems, which means star wound. Isn't that great? Craters, star wounds. They were recognized. And recently, the discovery of the iridium-rich layer at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary has made the subject very popular. The small crater referred to in Arizona, I can't remember how big it is, doesn't give its dimensions here, but it still is a major tourist attraction, but it is now certainly nothing like your major craters that have been discovered. There's loads in the anomaly books. With the help of magnetic sensors, scientists have detected a rimmed circular structure 30 miles in diameter, 30 miles, more than a mile beneath the floor of Lake Huron. They believe the magnetic ring marks a buried crater blasted by a meteorite at least 500 million years ago. Clever business, dating stuff. 5 miles, what is it, a mile beneath the floor of a lake. Still, there you go. That's from an article entitled Impact Crater May Lie Beneath Lake Huron from Science News. Thirty miles in diameter. Geologists have been searching in vain for a large crater that might account for the biological extinctions at the Cretaceous-Tertiary boundary some 65 million years ago. CJH Hartnady believes he had found the culprit. It's somewhat larger than expected, 300 kilometers in diameter, but it is of the right age. Supporting this notion is the observation that the Seychelles Bank and Madagascar suddenly shifted their locations at about this time. So, crater science, quite a young one, that is. And it is a subject, this is great, this is quite early on in the Velikovsky book, and I really liked it. I've tried to fill it a little bit. And it deals with meteorites, basically, and tells you what happened at the very beginning. It tells you exactly when it was that we started realising that rocks were falling from the sky after this had been written about for so long. A departure of the Earth from its regular rotation is thinkable, but only in the very improbable event that our planet should meet another heavenly body of sufficient mass to disrupt the eternal path of our world. The large number of asteroids between the orbits of the planets Mars and Jupiter suggests that at some unknown time, another planet revolved there. Now, only these meteorites follow approximately the path along which the destroyed planet circled the sun. Possibly a comet ran into it and shattered it. I think that technically it should probably be meteors rather than meteorites, a meteorite being something that like happened in Russia, enters the Earth's atmosphere and bursts into flames, which, thankfully, at least at the moment, that particular ring is not a hammered bracelet, I think it was called by the Babylonians. That a comet may strike our planet is not very probable, but the idea is not absurd. Innumerable comets, often seen only through the telescope, come flying in from immeasurable spaces of the universe at very great speed and disappear, possibly forever. And I think that's why people take the mickey out of old races who are frightened by comets, but imagine for a moment that you're faced with a close passage by a comet the size of Venus, yeah? I mean, don't bear thinking about really, does it? It's not something that's gonna pass you by without a bit of notice. Might it happen that our Earth would roll toward perilous collision with a huge mass of meteorites, a trail of stones flying at enormous speed around and across our solar system? From the time of Aristotle until the year 1803, when on April the 26th, a shower of meteorites fell at L'Aigle in France and was investigated for the French Academy of Sciences, the scholarly world, and in the meantime, remember, there'd lived Copernicus, Galileo, Kepler, Newton and Huygens, but until April the 26th, 1803, the scholarly world did not believe that such a thing as a stone falling from the sky was possible at all. And this despite many occasions when stones fell before the eyes of a crowd. Amazing, eh? The scholarly world did not believe that such a thing as a stone falling from the sky was possible at all, and this despite many occasions when stones fell before the eyes of a crowd. How about that? It's amazing, isn't it? Only shortly before 1803, the Academy of Sciences of Paris refused to believe that, on another occasion, stones had fallen from the sky. The fall of meteorites on July 24th, 1790, in southwest France, was pronounced un phénomène physiquement impossible. For those of you who didn't catch the crap pronunciation, that means a phenomenon that is physically impossible. Since the year 1803, however, scholars have believed that stones fall from the sky. And since then, as we've just seen, you've gone from acknowledging a small one to acknowledging a 30-mile one to acknowledging one that's 300 kilometres across. Slowly but surely, things become revealed. Such is the nature of apocalypse. If the head of a comet should pass very close to our path so as to affect a distortion in the career of the Earth, another phenomenon besides the disturbed movement of the planet would probably occur. A rain of meteorites would strike the Earth and would increase to a torrent. They referred in the documentary to the book of Joshua and says that two verses before the passage about the sun being suspended on high for a number of hours without moving, we find a passage which says, as they, the Canaanite kings, fled from before Israel, the Lord cast down great stones from heaven upon them unto Azekah, and they died. They were more which died with hailstones, stones of Barad was the word, than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. So it's just this storm of meteorites, basically, which saw to an army. There's actually a Thanksgiving prayer ascribed to Joshua as well on this occasion. It seems to summarize the situation pretty well. It says, sun and moon stood still in heaven, and thou didst stand in thy wrath against our oppressors. All the princes of the earth stood up, and the kings of the nations had gathered themselves together. Thou didst destroy them in thy fury, and thou didst ruin them in thy rage. Nations raged from fear of thee, kingdoms tottered because of thy wrath. Thou didst pour out thy fury upon them, thou didst terrify them in thy wrath. The earth quaked and trembled from the noise of thy thunders. Thou didst pursue them in thy storm, thou didst consume them in the whirlwind. Their carcasses were like rubbish. And the Book of Joshua relates the order of events that Velikovsky is primarily interested in. It says, Joshua went up from Gilgal at night in the early morning. He fell upon his enemies unawares at Gibeon and chased them along the way that goes to Beth Horon. As they fled, great stones were cast from the sky that same day, in the day when the Lord delivered up the Amorites. Ah, that's a reference by Velikovsky that, that's when there's a, he does manage to attach a lot of this stuff to the names of people in the Bible. He said, as they fled, great stones were cast from the sky that same day. The sun stood still over Gibeon and the moon over the valley of Ajalon. The Book of Joshua says that the luminaries stood in the midst of the sky. And allowing for difference in longitude, it must have been early morning or night in the Western Hemisphere. The sailors of Columbus and Cortez, when they arrived in America, found there literate peoples who had books of their own. Most of these books were burned in the 16th century by Dominican monks. There we go. There's another very effective way of mind control, is to burn the books of the cultures that you come across. We're told again and again that only 4 Mayan codices exist in the extant world, although I firmly believe that whilst maybe the original books didn't survive, that there probably still are transcriptions of this ancient knowledge around the place. Among the Indians of the days of the conquest and also of the following century, there were literary men who had access to the knowledge written in pictographic script by their forefathers. In the history of the empire of Culhuacan in Mexico, written in Nahua Indian in the 16th century, is related that during a cosmic catastrophe that occurred in the remote past, the night did not end for a long time. The Midrashim, the books of ancient traditions not embodied in the scriptures, relate that the sun and the moon stood still for 18 hours, and thus from sunrise to sunset, the day lasted about 30 hours, although it has to be said that without the regular motion of the sun, the people of those days, I suspect, would have had a fair degree of difficulty telling what the time was. Sahagun, the Spanish savant who came to America a generation after Columbus and gathered the traditions of the Aborigines, wrote that at the time of one cosmic catastrophe, the sun rose only a little way over the horizon and remained there without moving. The moon also stood still. Another common feature of the story there. The tradition that's preserved by Sahagun, although that's not exactly correct, I think what they did was they basically destroyed the tradition, and then I think Sahagun realized what had happened and endeavored to get the deeply pissed off locals to tell him what it had said in the books that they'd burnt, and that the resulting output was not always reliable, I gather. But the tradition nominally preserved by Sahagun bears no trace of having been introduced by the missionaries. The position of the sun, only a very little above the eastern horizon, differs from the biblical text, though it does not contradict it. We could follow a path around the earth and inquire into the various traditions concerning the prolonged night and the prolonged day, with sun and moon absent or tarrying at different points along the zodiac, while the earth underwent a bombardment of stones in a world ablaze. There was more than one catastrophe when, according to the memory of mankind, the earth refused to play the chronometer by undisturbed rotation on its axis. First, which is what will happen next week, guys, because we're coming up to Freeman Jack on tnsradio.com, and next week we're going to be looking at the single occurrences of cosmic catastrophes, some of which probably took place before the one that we've just looked at, and some took place afterwards, but we'll get to see exactly what it is that the eyewitness of the Egyptian accounts was saying, and how it lines up with the Exodus in the Bible, and we'll also get to see how it is that Velikovsky accounts very tidily for the 10 plagues of Egypt. Also, we'll be taking a look at some of the images and some of the ideas behind the Thunderbolts project and electric comet theory, which turns out to look really brilliant on the Thunderbolts project. But when I went and had a look at, I went and had a look at the European Space Agency site and one or two other main astronomical sites just to see what they were saying about comets, it is quite clear. It is absolutely and totally quite clear from NASA's very own experiments, which have been extremely expensive and, revelatory, that comets are not made of primordial ice and slush. And yet, if you go and look at the websites, that's exactly what they all say. Mind you, has to be said in fairness, some of them haven't been haven't been updated since 2009 or so, 2007 even, but next week we'll follow this story to a conclusion and also get a chance to have a look at some of the material that has been coming out of places like 3-Minute News on YouTube. Really recommend 3-Minute News. A lot of very interesting stuff about what's going on and under the Earth. And, of course, my favourite, my all-time favourite, Suspicious Observers, for some idea of what's going on in the atmosphere and in the solar system around us. All of that material we should reach without too much of a problem next week, with reference to this book that was published in 1950. One of the things that I'm sure must be the case is that surely Velikovsky wasn't the first. It's such a coherent body of data. It's so unusual and so effective in its ability to predict pretty unlikely things outside the Earth. Normally when I come across works like that, it's because much work has been done before. So anybody got any sources? Anybody got any stuff earlier than Velikovsky that's actually writing about this stuff and making these kind of identifications? And I know there's lots of people in the TNS chat box who are well up for this kind of material. Then do let me know. Send me links and stuff. As you can tell, I'm really on one at the moment. I'll want to look into more of this stuff. Shall hopefully very soon be getting a copy of Stanley Hall's books, because of course he was also a maverick, out there on his own, and looking at his theories concerning the birth of the cosmos, he's far closer, shall we say, to, far closer to Velikovsky than he is to orthodoxy, and has ideas indeed that are not made clear in Velikovsky's book. So we're now a mere 8 minutes away from Freeman Jack on TNSradio.com, ScottishSovereignsOnTheLand.com, and ScotlandIsFree.ning.com. I've really enjoyed being back with you. I really appreciate you all being out there listening, or whatever it is you've been doing whilst I've been rabbiting on. Thanks for all of it, really. Thanks to TNS, of course, for continuing to give me a place to come and talk about generally peculiar subjects to a bunch of people who I really do regard as friends and colleagues in a vast project. If we ain't going to do the work, guys, who the hell is?